You're tuned into the all-new Freedom 106.5. 106.5.
And now we step into our segment called Mind Matters, and this happens every Tuesday at this time at 11:15. And today we are speaking with Mr. Nicholas Voisin. Welcome to Freedom.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
You're very far in time. It's still morning.
Oh, sorry.
That's fine.
Long day already. That's why.
Don't worry. Sometimes when you wake up that early in the morning, it feels like 2 days within one. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Indeed.
So welcome. Yeah. Today, we are talking about masculinity, strength, vulnerability, and mental health well-being in Caribbean men. So let's start with the first question. And fellas, bear you know, patience listening to this one, right? When we say masculinity, what are we really referring to psychologically? Is it biology, culture, or learned behavior?
It's actually all of the above. Your masculinity is the way in which the male person interacts with the world. It is informed firstly by your biology, so whether you're born male or female, and then it's reinforced by your particular culture and circumstance and the obligations of that space. So in other words, men are usually a little bigger and stronger than women, so we are expected to do more of the heavy lifting, quote unquote, in a lot of spaces. And that happens, and that's what is expected of most men. But we also have different ways of seeing the world because we are bigger and stronger. I mean, in my own experience, I remember we were moving office and a young lady looked at a box and said, "Nicholas, that box looks heavy. I'm not lifting that." And the box was empty. She didn't even check. She just decided it was too heavy and left it. But as the man, I was expected to go and handle it. Yeah?
Mm-hmm. So,
it's an interesting combination of all of the above.
How do cultural expectations of Caribbean men, such as being the provider, protector, and emotionally strong, shape how men express or suppress emotions?
In fairness, that is not limited to Caribbean culture. The issue is not that we are expected to be provider and protector. That's expected about men generally around the world. Anthropologists have seen that. The three main characteristics that define maleness, masculinity around the world are provision, protection, and the other one is procreation. And you know Caribbean men good at least some of those. The problem in our Caribbean space is that our history has dictated that how you express those things of providing, protecting, and procreating tend to be dysfunctional. So we end up focusing solely on provision. So all I'm doing is going out working and bringing home the money. But that's not all that we're supposed to provide. We are also supposed to provide time and attention to our family and children, to our wife, our spouse, and our family, the children. We get that lost in translation somewhere. The protection is not just from burglars, it's from emotional harm. But nobody in the family unit to tell us that in the family of origin or to model that for us, then we don't know how to do it. Even with the procreative aspect, it's not just to go out and have as many children as you can. It is to have children in this family unit to raise them in a particular way so that they are good contributing members of the society. But unfortunately, we've been systematically destroying families over the last 50 years, so that now the most common type of household is actually woman-led. But women don't know anything about being a man. And much the same way as men don't know anything about being a woman. Yeah, that experience is unique to that particular gender, as it should be. So who is telling our boys when it is time for them to be men and what that means? Women have that opportunity because nature provides it. Nature provides a signal that says, hey, now you're a woman, you can have babies, and you start being treated differently by the adult women around you. If there's no man to invite you into the club to say, hey, now you're a man, or this is your task, this is what you have to do to get into the club, how do you know when you're a man? And if there's nobody to tell you what the things are that men are supposed to do, mm-hmm. then you flail about trying to figure it out on your own.
Side note, there's been examples within history and native communities of that ritual of separating young boys just as the preteens to become men, and they actually go like on a how to become a man trek or initiation ritual. I don't want to use the word ritual, but it's like a rite of passage.
Yes, it's a ritual, something you do that has meaning and purpose and particular form. Yes, in most cultures, in their primitive form, our developed sensibilities apparently no longer require that. But in most primitive cultures, there is a ceremony, a ritual that you must perform to move from boyhood to manhood. It's different in all over the world, but there is usually a ceremony that happens somewhere in the teenage years. And you stop being a boy one day and you're suddenly a man the next day. And the boy things you were doing yesterday, you can't do today.
And there were signals as well. You stop wearing short pants and then you wear trousers of thing. Yeah,
exactly. And daddy will start talking to you a little differently. He'll start letting you hang out with the boys. Yeah, and you get a different kind of conversation when you start hanging out with the men as opposed to when you're hanging out with mommy and the girls or the family. And now you know, oh, this is different. So men do different things when they're together than when they're with the women. Oh, okay. They treat the women and the children differently, and I am no longer treated like children. So you notice all of those things, and you notice the responsibilities. Oh, daddy has to do this. Daddy has to do that. Men do these things. But without somebody there to do that consistently, who's telling them? Who's telling us?
So the next question would be, why do many men struggle to talk about their mental health even when they are experiencing stress, anxiety, or depression?
Big boys don't cry. Isn't that what we've been taught since we were 3 or 4 years old? Big boys don't cry. So what does that mean? Not to be a man and to be strong, and that tells you your hurt and your pain are not important to us. It has no place here. We don't have room for it. So my sister can cry and she will get attention and comfort and support when she's hurt. When I am hurt, I'm expected to suck it up and move on. So my hurt and my pain is not okay. So when do I get an opportunity, first of all, to just put a name to it? If I can't name it, how am I supposed to know what it is? How am I supposed to know what to do with it? If I can't name it, how do I know how to control it? So I don't. And I keep putting it aside. And then it bursts out someday because I can't keep pretending and not feeling what I'm feeling. And it only bursts out because I do not get an opportunity to talk to somebody who can tell me how to go about managing it. That's why we behave badly.
So is it recommended that you start talking about how to express these feelings while discussing how the transition goes from being a young boy into a young man?
A man in his life has to be able to tell this young man, this young boy, yes, it is okay to feel these things, and these are the appropriate ways to express it. So if you're angry, it's okay to be angry. What are you angry about? Here's how you express that anger. You go and you cuff somebody in their eye, or you bust their head, or you're flipping over tables and mashing up things in the house. No, that is not acceptable. There are other acceptable ways to go about expressing your anger. There are other acceptable ways to go about dealing with conflict. But if you don't teach me, then I don't know. And then I do what comes instinctively, whatever I feel like doing and whatever has worked for me in the past. So if you and I have a disagreement, and when I disagreed with people before, I beat them up and they stop disagreeing and I win, that's what I'm going to do. But that's not really the best way to go about solving all of your conflicts, is it?
It is not. Clearly, we're seeing it on the global stage, the results. Let's go back to another question here inside the session. It says here, what is the difference between healthy masculinity and harmful or toxic masculinity from a psychological perspective?
That can be a really tricky question, because that toxic masculinity stuff is an outgrowth of an unhealthy feminist movement. But I suppose what they're getting at is a lot of the things that make it difficult to engage with a man. So the idea that I should only provide, or there are very specific roles for me and specific roles for you, and the two should not cross, that I am always in charge and dominant because I'm bigger and stronger, or I have the resources, or that I can treat you the way I want because I am bigger and stronger and have the resources. I suppose that would be the toxic masculinity. Some examples of the toxic masculinity, anything that pushes the expression of your maleness to an unhealthy extreme would be toxic. I suppose a healthy masculinity would then you being able to provide and take care of your family and friends and your country in a healthy and reasonable way. You defend when you need to defend. You do the heavy and difficult things when you need to, but you also have the ability to connect and to love and to be loved, more importantly, which I don't think we always get a chance to do.
You did talk about toxic femininity as well. I guess that would be a different topic altogether. Let's get another question in as we continue on Freedom 106.5 FM. How does emotional suppression in men impact their relationships as partners, fathers, and leaders?
So if we understand what an emotional suppression is, that means I feel something, and instead of speaking about it, instead of expressing it in a healthy way, maybe I cry, or my expression changes, my demeanor changes, I push it away. So you do something to hurt me, I push it away. You do something again to hurt me, I push it away. What that does is continue to reinforce, because nobody's seeing, nobody's asking what's going on with you. Nobody's genuinely checking in on him. He gets the impression that that's what you do. So it creates a false sense of responsibility in your relationships. And by relationships here, I assume they're referring to particularly romantic relationships. It sets up a situation where the only time your emotion comes out, or one of the few times your emotion comes out, is when you explode in anger. And then you say or do hurtful things. You hurt your partner's feelings, or might even hurt them physically in some way, because there's no control over the buildup. There's no proper management of the little day-to-day things. So maybe your partner said to you yesterday something that was a little hurtful. She make a bad joke. You know how trainees get when you're lying and you have a little bit of alcohol in your head. You try a little bad joke. And you take it seriously because it was something you said in confidence, but you don't know how to approach her well to say, hey, you know, I didn't appreciate that. I said that in confidence. Why would you say that in a public setting? That really hurt my feelings. No, the next time you say it is when we're arguing again, and you tell her all that you have to tell her about where she come from and where she have to go, and she this and she that and the other. You still don't get any resolution to the problem, because you don't say what it is. You just rant and rave and misbehave. So it creates a situation where men don't get to be their true selves. We have to be performing all the time, pretending that we're not hurt when we are. The sad thing about not being able to name your emotions is that you don't stop feeling them just because You don't have a name for them. You still feel them, but you don't know what it is. So sometimes you actually think you might be going a little mad because this thing happening and you don't know what it is and you don't know how to make it better. Panic attacks are rampant across the country because we are under so much tension. A lot of admittance, if you check the records, a lot of people being admitted to the hospital with quote-unquote chest pains, possible heart attack, is actually panic attacks. Because they've suppressed so much that it's bursting out physically now to tell them, hey, this is wrong, something's broken here, we need to fix it. We're on uneven ground, we're off kilter. We need to do something here. So how does that affect your partners? Well, if your partner can't connect with you in a real way, then who are they loving? Women, the wonderful creatures that you all are, realize much more quickly than we do when something is off emotionally. And you all tend to try and try and try and beg and plead. But very often it falls on deaf ears because that is not the version of man that I understand I should be. So I'm not going to be open and soft with you because that's not what I think I'm supposed to do. And then I hear all sorts of interesting stories about fathers who never held their children as babies. Absolutely never. Didn't start holding them until they were one because they were afraid they would break them or hurt them in some way. I'm like, what kind of rubbish is that? So you don't start bonding with your child until they're a year old. By that time, mommy is their world. They don't know you, you're a stranger. Making it even more difficult to have that loving, close connection with your children and your wife, because from what I've been told by a lot of women, seeing her husband, her child's father, love and take care of that child creates an even stronger bond and connection with her. So what are we doing? When you get to the aspect of leading, leadership, how can you lead properly if you can't manage your emotions well? If you're pretending all the time that things that hurt or things that bother you aren't, but you're acting out on them because they are. So in that space, in the leadership space, particularly in the family, it creates uncertainty with the partners, with the women, the wives, because you're going to be inconsistent. You're going to be very triggered by a lot of things so that they can't trust you with their emotional selves, maybe even with their physical safety. And that means you're not going to be doing a good job of leading because safety is one of the things you need to supply. Yeah?
How does emotional suppression in men impact their relationships as partners, fathers, and leaders? I think I just asked that one.
Yes,
what are the signs that a man may be struggling mentally, even if he is not openly expressing it?
Usually that he will withdraw. He will always be fine. No matter what's going on, he's fine. Even if something happens, if somebody dies, somebody close to him, and you say, well, okay, you know, this is a time when somebody's going to be hurt and grieving, and they're fine. And they're always fine. No matter what's going on, they're fine. That's a really good indication that something's up. Because that's the default suppression. That's the pretense. That's the facade that they're putting up, that they're okay. They'll be easily hurt by things. They tend to start withdrawing from things that are fun for them or that they like. Arguments might be a little faster in coming, particularly with persons close to them. So family members, romantic partners, because those people are able to trigger them a lot more easily because they're inside. Other things, he's definitely going to get lost in work and or some hobby that takes him away and distracts him. So if you find he's suddenly working long hours all the time or working more shifts and there isn't a specific monetary reason why, or job-related reason why. It's to stay away and to manage the emotions. The longer I can stay working, the less I think about the thing that's hurting me. Or the more time I spend in the hobby, whatever it is, playing games, running out with the guys, fishing or hunting or playing football or whatever it is, the less time I actually have to spend on emotional things. And as a lot of, oh, and of course the ubiquitous one, drinking. Yeah, all of a sudden I'm spending way more time in the rum shop or playing football with the guys or hockey with the guys or whatever the game is so that I can go drink with them until long after.
But isn't that a way to release stress, relieve tension, physical activity?
Physical activity, yes.
Okay.
But the physical activity isn't really reducing the stress because it's not doing as good a job as it's supposed to. And the purpose of going to the physical activity is not the physical activity, it's to get to the drinking afterwards. So instead of going to the basketball game, you have some fun and you have a beer or two with the guys after, you spend an hour playing the game and then you spend 4 hours drinking. You're not there for the activity, you're there for the drinking.
What does a psychologically healthy version of masculinity look like today? And how can men begin to develop it without feeling like they are losing their identity?
A healthy version of masculinity today would be a man who is confident in himself, understands that he has feelings beyond just hurt and pain when Manchester loses or your baby born or somebody dead. And he can express those things in a real and meaningful way on a consistent basis. He can do the things he is committed to doing. So he's a man of his word. So he does those things, the protection, the provision, and the procreation, but within healthy bounds. I know how much to work and I know how much to play. I engage with my partner and I love them and I allow them to love me back. Same with my family. I have healthy relations with other men that are my friends, that are my colleagues, and I'm open to dealing with the vicissitudes of life, all the ups and downs, yeah? And without, you don't have to lose yourself into some strange, soft, sweater-wearing version of you. There is room enough for everybody to be the version of man that they are.
How can workplaces, families, and communities create safer spaces for men to express vulnerability?
First of all, that actually speaks to the other gender, the women. You all have a very significant role to play in that. Very often women say, yes, we want men to be soft and gentle with us and thing. And then when he is, you laugh at him and you ask him if he's a Macomi man or this kind of man and that kind of man. And so then that signals that's not really what you want. We actually have to allow people, men and women, the space in our society, in the workplace, in homes, in cultural and social spaces to be themselves, to encourage them to say the things that are wrong, the things that are hurting them, and actually do something meaningful to address it. Don't just tell me, well, take a chill pill and grow up. Or grow up here. If this is something that is serious, help me work it out. That's why I'm saying that it's a problem, because I don't know how. Help me figure it out. Because there's nothing that we know that hasn't been taught to us directly or indirectly by someone else. We've had to learn everything along the way. So if you don't know, you don't know. Somebody's got to tell you.
And what about mentors and healthy groups? Because I know you, a little while ago you mentioned getting together with the boys can be used in a toxic way to escape. But how do you, can you tell the difference?
Because, to tell the difference?
How can you tell the difference here that this is a healthy activity rather than what you described before?
An addiction, your ability to leave it alone. So if I can go to the game, the activity and whatever, and don't have to drink afterwards, then it's likely not for that purpose. Or I manage my alcohol consumption in that space. I can go and lime with you guys for however long, but I have maybe one beer and I'm fine. If every time you go, you have to drink for the whole duration and you're going home intoxicated regularly, it's because you're trying to mood regulate with the alcohol. If you're always in everything, you're going to church and in every activity, you have a meeting every week and you're doing another one because the priest or the pundit or the pastor asks you to do something else, maybe you're running away from what's going on at home. And it's better you stay home and spend a little time and fix that than hide out and have it come back to bite you later. Mentors, yes, but men tend to be hesitant to reach out for those kind of things because, again, big boys don't cry. So we are very hesitant to admit that we are vulnerable in any way, shape, form, or fashion. So those things can be useful, but in my experience, they tend to be not well attended because we don't really create the space for it. It's getting better. It is getting better. I've been seeing a lot more men attending conferences and seminars and workshops to improve their sense of self and their engagement with others. But we still have a lot of work to do just to even catch up with where the women are with these things.
Mr. Wazan, I want to thank you so much for coming in and talking to us about the topic today, masculinity, strength, vulnerability, and mental health well-being in Caribbean men. And next week is another session with Mind Matters. Any closing remarks?
Yeah. There is room enough under the curve for everybody. The version of man that is you is welcome and acceptable. Don't be afraid to bring it out.
Thank you so much and enjoy the rest of your day.
I will. You too. Have a great one.
You're tuned into the all-new Freedom 106.5. 106.5.